It is 3:06 on a Friday afternoon. We're live in the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Midtown Atlanta. Time for another political rewind. A big, big day for us for many, many reasons. South Carolina Republicans go to the polls, as you probably know by now. In Nevada, there's a caucus which will pit Bernie Sanders against Hillary Clinton. And the state legislature, the state Senate this afternoon, is debating right now one of the most controversial and talked about bills of the session. It's on religious liberty, and we'll get to that during the show, too. With me is Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He writes a column on Thursdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the paper. He also, of course, oversees Political Insider, the online blog that keeps you up to date hour by hour on what's happening in politics. Also joining us today, Sandy Springs Mayor Rusty Paul. Rusty, it's a real pleasure to have you back in the studio. It's been quite a while. Rusty Paul is a former chair of the Republican Party here in the state of Georgia. He also worked in housing and urban development with Jack Kemp, who was in many ways, I think it's fair to say, a mentor.
Right.
And and Rusty also worked did some work for him on the presidential campaign. And we welcome back, after a long absence, Beth Shapiro. Beth is in an old life, was a Democratic political consultant and pollster. She has disavowed all relationships to that world, but she is still a trenchant observer of the political scene. Thanks for being here, Beth.
Thank you.
Okay. And that's all she's going to say for the next 50 minutes.
It's been nice being here. Thank you.
Jim Galloway, let's start with the Republicans in South Carolina. What an incredible week. So let's set it up by saying it looks in most of the polling, and we acknowledge it in the last couple of days, polling tends to be a little questionable, but it does look like Donald Trump is headed for a victory, if not a big victory here.
Yeah, let's say a substantial victory with the fight again for second place between Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. And I think it'll be very, very important if Ted Cruz does not finish in that second place.
Yeah, Rusty, let me come to you on this. So Marco Rubio gets an endorsement on, I think, Wednesday from the governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley. Let's listen to what Nikki Haley said in her endorsement, and then I want to talk to you about what happened next.
I want a president who understands that they have to go back to Washington, D.C. and bring a conscience back to our Republicans. Yeah. Our Republicans need to remember what we are about, which is about balanced budgets, cutting debt, building reserves, and making sure that they understand that this guy, he's all about term limits in D.C., and that's what we want to see in a president. We say that every day is a great day in South Carolina. Ladies and gentlemen, if we elect Marco Rubio, every day will be a great day in America.
So, Rusty Paul, in a normal campaign, the endorsement of a popular governor and the first minority governor in the history of South Carolina probably would mean something, yes?
That and the minority Republican Senator Tim Scott.
Tim Scott also endorsed.
Has endorsed, and which kind of belies the normal face of the Republican Party. I think you've got an Indian American, an African American endorsing a Latino Cuban American in the Republican Party. And I think it has had some effect. I mean, you've seen Rubio kind of go from crash and burn in New Hampshire and begin to stabilize and rehabilitate himself a little bit. And I agree with Jim. It's going to be interesting if Rubio can slide into second place tomorrow in South Carolina.
Well, one of the reasons I bring this up, the fact that this endorsement took place like on Wednesday, Beth, is so if we assume Trump is going to win in South Carolina and there's a battle for second and third, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Jeb Bush need as much attention, and John Kasich, although we'll talk about him later. They need as much attention as they can possibly get, including a lot of coverage of Nikki Haley. What happened? Donald Trump gets into a feud with the Pope, and everything else in political news is gone, right?
That's true. Now, in Trump's defense, which are not words that I often utter, in Trump's defense, the Pope started it. This was not Donald Trump taking on the Pope. This was the Pope commenting on how he perceived the Christianity of a candidate who would build walls. And it's mind-boggling to me. If you think about the past few months, we have had a major terrorist attack on our shores. We have had a consequential Supreme Court justice die, and that was merely a week ago. And then this week we have the Pope criticizing a major presidential candidate, and we're only in February. So I'm not quite sure how the rest of the year goes, but certainly have the feud with the Pope garners the attention, and some of Governor Haley's endorsement gets lost. I think that there's still a couple of days between Wednesday and Saturday to be traveling around the state and getting that out. So
you get the network if you don't get the attention. And now just to clarify, I mean, the Pope made the comments as he was flying back from Mexico to Vatican City, and what he said was that people who only talk about building walls and never talk about building bridges are not Christian. Now, didn't drop a name, but there's only one name that fits that.
Rusty, what was your take on all this?
Well, theologically, he's correct. Politically, he's wrong. And he should stick to theology. It did suck. I mean, that's what Trump has been able to do this whole presidential election. He's been able to say things, do things, be the, you know, one thing one day, something else, that no other candidate in my memory, and I studied the history of candidates for a long time, been able to get by with.
Let me ask you, Bill. Let me throw out a thought here, and I'd be interested to hear what Rusty and Beth have about this. But Donald Trump, I think, is making a fundamental change in the Republican Party. I mean, you have Ted Cruz right now. He's on an Antonin Scalia binge. You know, this race is now all about the Supreme Court, and he ticks off the culture war issues. That all will be affected by this. Donald Trump is out there saying no religious leader should be criticizing a politician's faith. That is contrary to the last 20 years of Republican politics.
Yeah, there's no question about it. But I think that what Trump, I mean, he's just unique in American politics, and it just kind of shows how scrambled our system is right now. I mean, you've got two candidates right now, Trump and Sanders, that probably four years ago would not have been even considered legitimate presidential candidates in this country. Yet here they are, the leading lights of their party. Now, with Trump, he seems to have a cap. And what gets lost in this is that he always pulls about 30%. So there's about 70% of the Republicans who would prefer somebody else. Now, the question was coming out of South Carolina, does the mainstream field of Kasich, Rubio, Bush, does that winnow down and get one-on-one? And what happens if one-on-one happens in the Republican primary? And that's really where, in my mind, the fight is right now. Which one of those mainstream candidates emerges tomorrow that can come into the SEC primary with the momentum that basically, because the other candidate, whoever comes in, fourth, fifth, sixth, their money is going to dry up.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the mainstream, the so-called establishment candidates. But before we get off Trump and the Pope, Beth, let me throw this out. We know that Donald Trump's approach to this entire campaign and to his business career is if he gets punched, he punches back hard. Okay, so it's, you know, right, we all have heard about the Pope on the plane back from Mexico to the Vatican being asked a question and responding with the comments he did. The next question is, in the long run, do you think voters are perfectly happy with a candidate who's willing to go so hard against the pontiff, the Pope, the head of the Roman Catholic Church? Forget about whether you're Catholic, Methodist, Presbyterian. have we gotten to the point where we are fully aware, accepting of that sort of approach to politics?
Well, I haven't seen or read what, if anything, Donald Trump has said today. I did read the statement that he issued, and for him it was a fairly temperate statement, expressing his disappointment in the Pope. I think you also had a couple of the other Republican candidates, Governor Bush, and I forget there
John
was one other,
Kasich.
Governor Kasich,
mm-hmm.
who came out and politely disagreed with the Pope stepping into the American election. So I think that I think what's interesting about what's happened with the Pope is the section of the country that we're now paying attention to, which is the South. And the Republican voting base in the South, or a key part of it, is evangelical Christians. And
in some cases, even anti-Catholic.
Anti-Catholic.
I didn't want to go there, but Rusty is nodding his head. In some cases, anti-Catholic. And even if not overtly anti-Catholic, a lot of conservatives are not happy with this particular Pope because they feel he's too liberal on some of the hot button social issues. So in a way that the Pope may not have intended, his being critical of Donald Trump may actually help Donald Trump in some quarters in the South.
Yeah, it's worth noting that Bob Jones University is in Greenville, South Carolina.
Well, I think that if this had happened 2 weeks from now, when the contest moved to the Midwest, where you have a much higher Catholic population, that it would have probably had much more impact than it will here in the South. I think it's a fun story for a few days, and then we'll be off on something else. The next person who insults Trump will be...
I suspect if Trump is a smart guy...
He's already backing off.
So let me just to put a period on this part of the conversation. You know, as we've looked at the response to this, there have been a lot of people who have been unhappy about the Pope stepping in, and, you know, you think, well, perhaps the Church will back away from this, but there was an op-ed piece in Washington Post this morning by Father James Martin, who is a Jesuit, as is the Pope. And here's what he says in one part of his article. He says, Pope Francis he first says, like any good Jesuit, the Pope says he's going to give benefit of doubt to Trump. But then here's what Father Martin goes on to say. Pope Francis is correct. Any person who consistently speaks of excluding people, who trumpets his desire to literally build more walls between communities, and who manifests a desire to increase division is not walking the Christian way. I suspect that this will become part of the dialogue moving forward.
I think the father is talking to general election voters.
Well, let me say this.
Midwestern voters.
Right.
let me say this, that I've heard some conservative reaction to the Pope's comment yesterday, which goes to something Beth just said, which is the perception among conservative Catholics that he's more liberal than they feel comfortable with. The question is being asked, well, he's going after Trump, but he has said absolutely nothing about Biden and Pelosi and other pro-choice Democrats as far as in the same context. And they are saying if he wants to be consistent about theology, he should be saying the same thing about politicians who support other aspects of Catholic dogma that don't support it as they should on Trump. There has been some conservative reaction in that way.
Okay, so let's move on. Rusty, you've already set this up for us, really. We think that, you know, Trump probably comes away the winner tomorrow. Next question, is Ted Cruz second? So that as they head to Georgia, you've got Cruz and Trump really coming into a head-to-head cage match. So, or what about Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush? I'm going to play a really, really short clip. It's only like 3 seconds long. But I think in that 3 seconds, you hear something that, if you're a Bush supporter, is really kind of troubling. This was Jeb Bush was asked as he was getting into a car what he thought about the endorsement of by Nikki Haley of Marco Rubio.
He's a great person. I'm disappointed she didn't endorse me.
Now, okay, maybe you don't hear what you see, but Jim Galloway, when I saw that clip, he looked like the most dejected human being on the face of the earth.
It was worse than please clap.
which was pretty bad.
It's got to be disheartening. Look, I mean, for this man's entire lifetime, he's the guy who should have been president. And the one time he is trying to become president, it's just not working at all. I mean, he's a fellow 20 years out of his time.
He's never gained his footing in this campaign. He's been uncomfortable from the very beginning. I went to an early event here in Atlanta when he was here for some fundraising. I actually wrote a check. And I could tell then he was still searching for a message, which is not unusual early in a campaign. You're uncomfortable. But he's never really gotten comfortable with this whole process. I think he felt that, you know, I'm going to walk in, my dad, my brother, and he's had to fight in ways that I don't think he anticipated. And he's been off balance from day one. And as that clip, I think, Bill, you're right. It very eloquently says, you know, this is just not happening.
So, go ahead, Beth. Jump in.
With Governor Bush for a second. On the show Wednesday, Todd Rehm, respected Republican political consultant, a pretty astute guy, said that he thought that almost no matter what happens to Governor Bush tomorrow, that because of the Bush network throughout the country, that he's got the ability to keep going forward. And I'm curious. Rusty.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and I was going to go to it. That was then, yeah. This is now, and Rusty, you're well aware, there are suddenly people in the Bush campaign, more than ever, saying if he comes in a poor fourth to Marco Rubio, or even whatever, fourth to Cruz or Rubio, that there's going to be their donors are just not going to be there for him.
It campaigns, as Beth knows, you know, you have investors. And like any other business, if your investors walk away from you, you're out of business. And his investors are very concerned, and he's already had to pull back some advertising. He's running short of money as it is. And at some point, you just simply have to acknowledge reality, that it's just not going to happen. And I would think that if he comes in at the end of the pack tomorrow, he's got to look in the mirror Sunday morning and say, Is this really worth going on?
At some point, the Bush reputation for party loyalty kicks in.
Yeah.
And because the longer the year establishment candidates hang out there in the field, if they're not doing well, the further Trump gets in terms of delegate collection.
So, in fact, Rusty, my understanding is that Right to Rise, the Bush super PAC, had reserved time, TV time here in Georgia, and they have so far decided not to pursue those buys. They're not following up. They've canceled the reservations for time. That's your understanding.
Oh yes. And as Beth knows, I mean, they get up every morning and look at the overnight polls and see where they have opportunities, and the money flows to where the opportunities are.
Well, you know how popular a lot of your colleagues in the ranks of Republican elected official leadership got behind Jeb Bush. In part, our friend Eric Tannenblatt made a very solid pitch for why they should. Do you think Georgians, is it going to be disappointing if Georgians don't get a chance to weigh in on Bush? Or is the feel, are the conditions here such that it's going to be Cruz or Trump, and that's the way it's going to line up?
I don't think the average Republican voter today cares.
Okay.
About Jeb Bush, you know, whether he's going to be there or not. They have already, in my mind, the ones I've talked to, have already said, we love Jeb, it's just not happening, let's go on.
Look, if Jeb survives South Carolina tomorrow, his first trip has got to be into Georgia, and he's got to have a sit-down with Governor Nathan Deal.
Talk about the water wars and how that's played in. Your paper, the Atlanta Constitution, had a good story on that this morning.
Right, this is Greg Bluestein sitting down with the governor and going over his endorsements. At the outset, Governor Deal said, "I'd be fine with any one of four governors running for president: Huckabee, Bobby Jindal, Jeb Bush, and
Kasich.
Not John Kasich. He doesn't like John Kasich. I'm missing
I'm trying, Kasich. Guys,
Kasich's
I'm
a Medicaid
That's
guy.
Right.
Rick Perry.
All but Jeb Bush, of course, are out now. And so Greg asked the governor. So this is tantamount to an endorsement. He said, not yet. He says he's got to have a very pointed conversation with Jeb Bush about Florida's position on the tri-state water wars, arguing over water that flows down the Chattahoochee, how much water we can draw out, how much water needs to flow into their basin. And he says if he doesn't get the answer he wants, there's not going to be an endorsement, because he can't have a president in the White House who is lining up against Georgia.
Well, he's got two of them in the race, Rubio
and
Bush.
Deal has already ruled out Marco Rubio.
Yeah.
Before we finish up this segment, Beth, conversely, if somehow luck smiles upon Jeb Bush and not on Marco Rubio, if Rubio should end up in fourth place, he too is going to have to make an argument with his donors that they ought to keep investing in him to move forward. And it seems to me Rubio's in a very similar position to Bush, even if he is the fair-haired child of the establishment.
He very much is, considering his stumbling performance in the New Hampshire debate, which hurt him badly in the primary there, and which still haunts him. Now, he appears to have regained his footing, but we'll know a whole lot more tomorrow about how solid the ground is that he's on.
Yeah, I would make the argument that Ted Cruz is more vulnerable here. If he doesn't finish well in South Carolina, I mean, good. You remember us talking to Rick Tyler, his spokespeople, Cruz's spokespeople, who said that Cruz has got to unite the evangelical vote with the very conservative people, with the libertarian people, and that's how he wins. So far, he hasn't been able to do that.
So you're telling me that I am making a bad assumption to just imagine that Cruz is the logical number two. That's interesting.
I think he's got to worry about it.
Yeah, I do too. There are two candidates who've lost a little bit of steam this week, which are Trump and Cruz. I think they both came in expecting to do extremely well in South Carolina. And we're still at that situation where expectations still matter. And so the expectations for those two candidates are high. If they underperform tomorrow and the others overperform, you're going to get a lot of conversation for the first 3 days of next week.
Oh, my God, it's going to be even more exciting than I realized. Yeah, Thank you for that. All right, we got to get to a break, but I want to finish up with the Republican field. Rusty, you think you like John Kasich.
I do.
Yesterday, you know, we've talked about the coarsening dialogue. We've talked about the rough and tumble of this campaign. But yesterday was one of those rare moments, at least in the 2016 cycle, where we saw a humanity, a genuine kind of compassion emerge. It was in a conversation Kasich had in yet another one of his many town meetings. And it was a UGA student who drove up to see him. Right? We need any other setup for this?
No, it was Clemson University.
Right, right.
It's only 90 minutes between there and Athens.
Yeah. Right. So let's play this just to remind ourselves that there can be a heart in this campaign.
I drove up today from the University of Georgia, and sorry for y'all, but I did it because I wanted to let you know and let everyone else here know why I'm supporting you and why that support is unwavering. And I don't want to get too emotional, but it's pretty serious, but it has a happy ending. over a year ago, a man who was like my second dad, he killed himself. And then a few months later, my parents got a divorce. And then a few months later, my dad lost his job. And I was in a really dark place for a long time. I was pretty depressed, but I found hope. And I found it in the Lord and in my friends. And now I've found it in my presidential candidate that I support. And I'd really appreciate one of those hugs you've been talking about.
Don't you see that's what it's about? We can rebuild the country, sir, and we can get people on their feet, and we can grow. But is there any substitute for what you just heard? There isn't. So as Americans...
What we saw, excuse me, in the video is Kasich did come over and give this kid a bear hug, Rusty.
Yeah.
Long bear hug.
And you know, I'm entering my 39th year in public service at some level or another. And you all know me very well and know that my mentor was Jack Kemp. And I've always looked at politics as a calling, a positive calling. I've spent my life in it, and I would hate to think it was in a negative sense. And so I really respond to the Jack Kemps and the John Kasichs of the world who come out and try to be compassionate. The coarsening, Beth and I talked this before we came on out, the coarsening of our dialogue in politics and how we treat each other as a country really matters. And this was an instance where with all the negativity and all the criticism, we had a real rare human moment that typifies what politics ought to be about, not what it's become.
Yeah, we should say as we go to this break that I have to say the covering Jack Kemp was one of the great experiences of my career as a political reporter because of all the things you just said. He was a genuinely caring human yes. being and a uniter. He was a guy who figured out ways to make bridges, That's not right. walls. And I especially remember that he frequently, when he came to Atlanta, instead of staying at some downtown hotel, stayed out at Pascal's Motor Lodge.
Oh, yeah. I was advanced on that trip.
All right. Well, look, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Democratic caucuses in Nevada, where Hillary Clinton is maybe on the ropes and going to head to South Carolina, perhaps more wounded. We'll see about that. And then later, we're going to check in on the Senate debate going on right now over one of the religious liberty bills. You're listening to Political Rewind. It is 3:32.
Presidential campaigns have been slicing up voter groups for years. This cycle, the Ted Cruz campaign has been taking it to the next level, mining data about voters' personalities and behavior.
And I will apologize to nobody for using every tool we can to encourage Iowa voters to come out and vote.
Beyond micro-targeting later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Political Rewind with Bill Nigut here on GPB, an 18-station radio network of Georgia Public Broadcasting. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University with 8 colleges and schools, including the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies.
We're back. Sandy Springs Mayor Rusty Paul at the table with us, Beth Shapiro, and Jim Galloway. Thank you all for being here. By the way, we have a new Twitter handle. It's Politics GPB, and we would love to have you tweet us your thoughts. Get on the Twitter. Tell us what you think about the conversation we're having today. Beth Shapiro, there was a point not long ago when Hillary Clinton was about 20 points up, according to the polls, on Bernie Sanders out in Nevada. We know that caucus states are much more difficult to poll than primary states. Nevertheless, everything seems to suggest they're neck and neck in Nevada right now. What the heck does that mean as they turn south, because they have South Carolina a week from tomorrow?
I think that Nevada, I wouldn't call it a must win for Clinton. I think that if she doesn't win, she needs to lose it by just a couple of percentage points. I still think that once the campaigns head south and to an electorate that is much more to Clinton's liking than New Hampshire, Iowa, and Nevada, in that the Southern Democratic electorate is majority black, white Democrats, and there are still some of us. I know we're an endangered species, but there are still some of us. White Southern Democrats, particularly those middle-aged and older, tend to be a little more moderate, and that's with all due respect to my friends in the Free Republic of Decatur and other liberal enclaves in the state. I know there are Sanders supporters among white Democrats in the state, but I do think that she's on much friendlier terrain in the South. I think today she was due to be receiving, I think it was at 3 o'clock this afternoon, the endorsement of Congressman Jim Clyburn, yep. who is the black representative from South Carolina, the dean of the congressional delegation in South Carolina, and a key figure in South Carolina yep. politics. So I think she will be among the happiest people to get out of Nevada, I hope she doesn't. And I do support her. I'm not involved in the campaign. I do support her.
It's worth just reminding ourselves that Nevada is probably is in far worse shape economically than Georgia. The unemployment rate there, I think, is well above 6%. even as the national level, I think, is right at 5.
Yes, but we're also going to see a significant turnout, we imagine, of Hispanic voters, of minority voters who, you know, aren't necessarily, certainly you can't lump them in with other minorities, but nevertheless, if Sanders takes a significant share of that vote, it's worth noting, isn't it, Jim?
Oh no, absolutely. And you do have some, I think one area where Hillary may be weak is among rank-and-file union. In Nevada.
Well, she has received the endorsements of most unions in Nevada.
Oh, yes.
The one that is not endorsing because they got burned by what they did 8 years ago is the, I don't know the exact name, but it's the tourist industry. It's the hotel workers, which is a large and significant union. But she's received the endorsement of other unions,
which implies the ability to
turn people out at the caucus.
Right, but what I'm seeing here in Georgia, I'm seeing a lot of rank and file members of unions line up behind Bernie Sanders.
Let me ask this question: why, if I'm Hillary Clinton's strategist, and you guys know a lot more about what goes on that side than I do, but why double down in Nevada when you can come in here and you could just say, look, Nevada's interesting, but I'm going to South Carolina, I'm going to the SEC states. She's doubled down in Nevada when things started going bad. Why didn't she just say, look, I'm going here and this is where my focus is going to be, and then just kind of concede it and then go in and win big?
And I think it's
because of the importance of Nevada to Sanders. Sanders needs to prove that he can win in places other than places that are overwhelmingly white. And so Nevada starts to get us into states with a more diverse electorate. I think it's roughly 15% African American, 15% Latino. And so if he comes out of there with a sizable win, then that reinforces
his
message that I can win.
But if she doesn't compete, if she says, look, it's not significant enough, and she concedes it, then she doesn't lose.
I think there was a decision within the Clinton campaign coming out of New Hampshire that says we're going to stress Bernie Sanders' resources as far as we can, and we're going to challenge him everywhere.
There was a report yesterday morning that the Clinton people met with some of their top donors over the last few days and said, prepared him. We're not doing as well in Nevada as we thought. Don't lose hope. We're heading south. We're going to make up for all that ground there. The very fact that they apparently are having those conversations isn't a great
sign. Well, Jim, that you kind of – my point is if Bernie Sanders wins Nevada, he's going to raise another $3 million at $27 a pop. So why would you risk that in a state that's really just kind of sitting out there, has no real delegate strength, and focus on where you know you're going to win, and then that becomes less of a story.
Right. Okay, let me go to the Twitter. Jeff Mack says, considering how well Bernie is doing, I think Elizabeth Warren could have won this primary, and probably the general. Jim?
No, I don't think so. No.
Poor Jeff Mack isn't here to defend himself. All right. So, Jim, you and I have been saying on this show for weeks and weeks that the Clyburn decision on what to do about the Democratic race was crucial. Beth has referred to the fact that Clyburn is now endorsing Hillary Clinton. That really is a big deal for her in South Carolina.
It officially heals the wound that was created in 2008 when Bill Clinton went into campaign in South Carolina on his wife's behalf and began comparing Barack Obama's candidacy to that of Jesse Jackson and other kind of more symbolic campaigns by African Americans.
All right.
I think
go ahead.
Just a couple more things about South Carolina, and then also as you get into Georgia. In the AJC today, there's an interesting little blurb about an ad that Ben Carson is running on South Carolina radio, presumably aimed at African-American voters, telling them, criticizing Bernie Sanders. Now, I would be the first to admit that I don't understand what Ben Carson is doing much of the time anyway, but I don't know why he would be attacking a Democrat. But in this case, his attacking Bernie Sanders, if the intended audience is African-American voters, could well redound to help Hillary Clinton in South Carolina. And it was just, I read it twice because I thought, maybe this is not true, but it was in the AJC. One
suspects he's not getting good advice.
Yeah. Well, really. Okay. So as long as we're talking about the Democrats, of course, we discussed the other day that Bernie Sanders was at Morehouse, had a big rally. We'll see how far that gets him in terms of mobilizing voters. But I missed an item that apparently got a delayed kind of pickup by the news media. Killer Mike, who is a big supporter of Bernie Sanders and one of the most prominent hip-hop artists today. And by the way, Killer Mike, if you're listening, we still have an open invitation for you to appear on Political Rewind. He made a comment during his very rousing talk that turns out to have generated quite a bit of controversy and has gotten some national attention. Let's just listen to it and talk about whether it has any significance or not.
When people tell us, hold on, wait a while, and that's what the other Democrat is telling you, hold on, Black Lives Matter, just wait a while. Hold on, young people in this country, just wait a while. And then she get good. She have your own mama come to you, your mama sit down and say, well, you're a woman. But I talked to Jane Elliott a few weeks ago, and Jane said, Michael, a uterus doesn't qualify you to be president of the United States.
Beth Shapiro? Look, this has generated a great deal of controversy in the last couple of days, as if at playing into the scenario that there are people who are supporting Bernie Sanders because they essentially are anti-woman.
I don't think that's how I don't interpret it that way. I just think it was an unfortunate and indelicate choice of words that, again, as a Clinton supporter, I'm glad to see Sanders having to scramble a little bit to wade through that. But it does come back to the gender issue. It's kind of ironic that he talks about we're being told to wait. When I think that was a feeling that some of Clinton supporters felt in 2008 in terms of support of Senator Obama or support Senator Clinton. So I think it's one of these little things that in the era of the Twitter, Bill, you're showing your age, but in the era of the Twitter, it goes around and it's gone in a day or two.
Now, I don't have a uterus, so I may not be qualified to talk about this, but the way I knew that this was registering is I was looking on my tweet deck, not the Twitter, tweet deck. I clicked on a link, and it took me to the one place I didn't expect that would be talking about it, and that was cosmopolitan.com.
Well, it shows you the danger of surrogates.
Well, it does. I thought I heard you play a little bit of the woman's card there at the end of what you had to say about all of this. That we don't have to wait. It now is our turn. Is that what I heard
say? No, I think that was part of what Secretary Clinton, or Senator Clinton, then Senator Clinton, was hearing in 2008.
Okay.
No, not now. No.
Okay. By the way, our young producer, Jenny Ament, just said the same thing that you're all saying. It is Twitter, not the Twitter. Excuse me. I come down with Julie Mason, who is on POTUS Radio, one of the best political people out there, and she calls it the Twitter. I happen to like that
Well,
language.
Bill, you need to get to Instagram. If you really want to be up to date, you need
you're
to be
right.
Instagram.
By the way, it's Politics GPB. If I said that in the wrong order, Politics GPB is our Twitter handle. Contact us on the Twitter and talk to us. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break. There's some really interesting state news developing that we want to get to. It's 3:44 in the afternoon. I'm here with Sandy Springs Mayor Rusty Paul, Democrat Beth Shapiro, and AJC political writer Jim Galloway. Back in a minute.
Got a used car that's taking up space in your garage or driveway? Donate it to GPB. We'll take care of everything from picking up the car for free to sending you the paperwork for your tax deduction. Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR. That's 877-472-1227, and thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Mayor Paul, Rusty Paul, let me come to you first, if I may. This week, the Senate Transportation Committee passed out the MARTA bill, which, correct me if I'm wrong, would take allow for local municipalities to have their voters decide whether a half penny of the penny they're already paying, thanks to the transportation bill last session, earmarked specifically for MART expansion. Have I got that right?
Yeah, basically, what we've been involved in for about 5 months now. And I'm going to say something. When I first came out in support of MART, I think that raised some caused a little shockwave around that a Republican was supporting MARTA.
Because you look always like the guy who'd be driving a big car down 400.
I have a pickup truck, so it's big, though. But the Fulton County Commission, which I've railed against for 30 years, has actually just done a 180 and has been very responsive and responsible in leading an effort by the 14 cities in Fulton County to come up with a real plan for dealing with traffic and congestion in Fulton County. And under John Eve's leadership, and I have to give him credit along with Liz Hausman, they've worked very well together. They brought together all the mayors, including the mayor of Atlanta, and on the MARTA compromise. Now, the compromise is that the Atlanta would be able to put half a penny toward MARTA. The rest of Fulton County for the first 5 years would put 0.75 cents to roads and a quarter penny to
thanks
MARTA.
For the correction.
And then 5 years beyond that, for the next 35 years, it would be 50-50.
Thanks.
And so as a result, we had a 13, with the county commission, a 14-1 vote in favor of that, with only the mayor of Alpharetta being negative. Even Mike Bodker, the mayor of Johns Creek, who's not a real fan of some of MARTA's plans, and Mayor Reed, who's not a fan of giving so much to roads, at least were willing to vote to let the process go. And I know there was a lot of criticism when the new cities came on board. You're going to do away with regionalism. You'll never be getting any problems solved. I think that vindicates what we said all along, that these cities are like Lego blocks. You can attach them and detach them in ways that allow you to make good policy decisions for local, but yet come together regionally in ways. And I think that was a watershed moment in Georgia politics, just the fact that you had Republicans, Democrats, blacks, whites, all sitting around a table coming to a consensus on the biggest problem we have in this region.
What's changed? We all watched the T-SPLOS, the transportation sales big package a few years ago, go up in flames in the Metro Atlanta region and most of the state. What's changed
in your
opinion?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, MARTA's gotten its act together. Keith Parker has done an amazing job. He and Robbie Ash working together have done an amazing job of cleaning up the managerial problems that MARTA has been plagued with almost since the beginning. So there's confidence among the political folks anyway that MARTA can deliver. And remember, we're still dealing with the political class. The T-SPLOS, 2 years ago got here too. So this is still the political class talking. We haven't gotten to the voters yet. But that's part of it. Secondly, there's a new Fulton County Commission with a younger generation who haven't been scarred by the previous battles, and they've come together and really focused on, and it's biracial and it's bipartisan and it's across jurisdictional lines, really come together and said, let's solve the biggest problem that this region faces, which is traffic and congestion. And it's been an amazing experience for somebody like me who really wants to focus on solving problems. There's a like-mindedness between MARTA being able to get their act together, and there's confidence there with the rest of the folks coming together, understanding how important this is. And it's been an amazing experience for me.
There's also been a big change in attitude here when it comes to transit. The Metro Atlanta Chamber has a very, very interesting poll that it took out in October, so it's a little bit dated, but it should still be holding up, in which it basically said that almost half of the voters in Fulton County and DeKalb County would vote against a transportation package if it didn't include money for transit. That means you have a situation where the roads and bridges folks can veto anything that the transit people put forward, but the transit people can now veto anything that the roads and bridges people put forward.
And what that poll also found, and it was done by McLaughlin and Associates, with a reputable national pollster.
It was my pollster when I was party chairman.
It used to be a reputable national, pollster. They, McLaughlin is the governor's pollster, the lieutenant governor's pollster, and Rusty Ball's pollster. What they found was that in addition to this, the vetoing of any spending that didn't include transit, was that 73% of voters in Fulton and DeKalb counties said that they would support spending up to a half penny more to pay for transit. And it wasn't, so it's not just a pie in the sky, do you support transit? It was the hard question of would you pay for it? And almost three quarters of voters in both counties said they'd pay for it. And you had majorities in every demographic group, including Republicans.
You know, we should say, Rusty, Jim Galloway and I sat here one day late last year with Robbie Ashe, chairman of MARTA, you mentioned him, came in, and he laid out for us his $8 billion MARTA expansion plan. And I think our mouths kind of dropped open because it seemed to be an unattainable dream. It would extend MARTA all the way up to
Windward Parkway,
and then take it east, quite a distance.
Right. It would connect Emory and CDC from Lindbergh, and then there's the I-20 piece that goes out. There's another data point that I want to give you that I think goes to the point that Jim just made. We're doing our land use plan in Sandy Springs, and we did a survey of our residents, and one of the questions that was asked was, if you could go where you wanted in an efficient, timely manner, would you be willing to get out of your car, or do you want to get in your car and go? 70% of our citizens said if they could get where they wanted to go without getting in their car, they would. That's why you've seen the change, and I think I'm hoping. I mean, we're going to go through a tremendous amount of upheaval when the 285 interchange. And I'm hoping that it'll be painful enough that it'll get people on MARTA. I'm not wishing for pain for my citizens, but I know it's going to happen. And as a result, I think you'll see more and more people taking MARTA and getting used to it, and the growing demand will be there.
All right, we've got to move on because we want to get to one other topic. Jim Galloway, the Senate has been debating, and you just were following the debate on your computer, on your iPad. It appears they're kind of getting to the end of the debate. Let's be clear. The House passed virtually unanimously, the Pastor Protection Act, which merely says if you're a clergy person, you don't have to marry people you don't want to marry, like gays and lesbians. Came to the Senate, and in the Rules Committee, they attached Senator Greg Kirk's, much more contentious measure, which gives certain protections to businesses that don't want to do business with gays and lesbians, right?
He called it the First Amendment Defense Act, and it would. They've altered the language so that it would say that you can't discriminate against anybody who's doing something because of their belief in whatever kind of marriage they believe in. It's fogged up the language a little bit there. It's still likely to be contested in court if it's ever passed.
Okay, but the Senate right now they're about to vote.
They're debating it. There's already been a preliminary vote over engrossment that was defeated with no problem at all, which indicates to me that the Senate's going to pass it. They will send it to the House. I don't know that there's enough time left in the day for the House to take it up.
Maybe not today, but Beth Shapiro, the question is that I've been wondering about is if the House was trying to do something that would be the most palatable form of a religious liberty bill. This was David Ralston's idea. Pastor protection seemed to be it. Now they're suddenly having to deal with a bill coming back at them, which adds this amendment that at least the leadership over there really didn't want to have to take up. What's going to happen next?
Well, I think it's not just adding this particular amendment. Of all the, there are six or seven so-called religious freedom bills that have been floating around. Of all the ones out there, this is the one that potentially is the most damaging to gay and lesbian citizens of Georgia. There apparently are some constitutional questions that are being raised by it, so I agree with Jim. I'd be surprised if it gets to the House in time for a vote today. I expect that there will be a little more study of it. I think what's interesting is that thinking about Rusty's point about MARTA and the change in attitudes, we spend a lot of time in Georgia looking at the state in terms of how attractive are we for people to move here, to bring their businesses here, to come to have conventions and meetings here. And we want to send a message of being welcoming and of being part of the 21st century. Having a rail line, a transit system that moves people around the metro area easily is certainly a piece of that. Having legislation that says to a certain class of people that when it comes to public accommodations, you're not welcome here, mm-hmm. is not part of the message that we want to be sending. And so I think that the risk for the state is that we have the Indiana effect, in which the state of Indiana immediately lost millions of dollars worth of business when they passed legislation that was unwelcoming.
Let's be clear on one thing. You've both talked about it getting to the House today. There is no deadline today. This is not a magic moment. You're merely making the point. I think, Rusty, you probably
get... I think the House is already adjourned.
Well, but from a strategic point of view, I'm assuming that what they're suggesting is if you could have gotten this back over to the House and gotten it up for a vote immediately when there was no opportunity for opposition to form, for people to get entrenched.
A weekend of discussion matters.
Right, exactly.
It does. No, there's no question. And I don't think even if it had come back over today that Speaker Ralston would have scheduled it for a vote. That's not normally the way the House works. This shows the primary fault line in my party right now. It's between the business Republicans, the Wall Street folks and even a lot of the Main Street folks and social conservatives. This is something that really matters to the social conservative wing of the Republican Party. And it scares the business wing half to death for the very reasons that Beth outlined. And this is one of those things, they're walking a tightrope and there's no net. Because either way that they go, they lose in this situation. And that's the worst position that any political leader wants to be in, because they're going to, as Beth said, there will be businesses who will not come, there will be conventions that don't come, but these folks got to go home and see those voters.
All right, we are out of time. Rusty Paul, mayor of Sandy Springs and former chair of the Republican Party of Georgia. Beth Shapiro, a Democrat who no longer consults or polls for Democrats. And Jim Galloway, our friend and constant companion from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
That's because she's retired, not because she no longer will be associated with Democrats.
Thank you for that clarification. I'm very grateful for that. A couple quick notes. South Carolina vote Republicans tomorrow, and they're going to be heading to Georgia, those Republican candidates. So by next Wednesday, when Political Rewind is back on the air at 2 p.m., we will probably have a great deal to talk about. Donald Trump is in town on Sunday. Rusty Paul has opened the Sandy Springs
City Hall
for town meetings with any candidate who wants one. And the first one you took up.
First one is John Kasich.
What a surprise.
And he'll be there Tuesday night, the 23rd at 6 o'clock. So I hope everybody comes see him.
All right. And next Friday, we're really excited about the fact that we're going to be doing our show live from the State Bar of Georgia, where they're going to be holding their annual bar media conference. Judges,
there were going to be drinks,
attorneys, and reporters, and we're all going to be there live doing the show in front of them. Their questions will be very interesting, I have no doubt. Harper Lee passed away this morning. We've been scrambling all day, Jenny Ahmed and I, to do a two-way street to pay tribute to her. It'll be on the air tomorrow at 4 and again Sunday at 11 in the morning. Thanks for listening to Political Rewind today. We'll see you again next Wednesday at 2.